His was the first name on my list of prospects. "Hello," I say, without calling his name, and we shake hands. He sits down with a bottle of beer. He is also wearing sunglasses and a cap, and he's dressed like he's ready for tennis. Tanned and handsome, with only a few streaks of gray. We're about the same age, but he looks younger. "Come here often?" I ask. "Yes. We own two shopping centers in Nassau, so my wife thinks I'm here on business." "Why are we really here?" "Let's take a walk," he says, standing. We stroll along the harbor, saying nothing, until we enter a large dock with 100 boats. He says, "Follow me." We step down to a lower platform, and he points to a beauty. It's about 50 feet long and designed to venture far into the ocean and catch those sailfish you see stuffed and hanging on walls. He jumps on board and reaches to steady me. "This is yours?" I ask. "I own it with my father-in-law. Let's take it for a spin." He gets two beers from a cooler, settles into the captain's chair, and starts the engines. I recline on a padded sofa and breathe in the salty air as we putter through the harbor. Before long, a fine mist is spraying my face. Tyler grew up in Palm Beach, the son of a prominent trial lawyer. He spent 8 years at the University of Florida pursuing degrees in political science and law, with plans to go home and join the family firm. His life was derailed when his father was killed by a drunk driver a week before he was scheduled to take the bar exam. Tyler waited a year, managed to pull things together, passed the bar exam, and found a job in Seabrook. With his future employment always secure, he had not troubled himself with diligent studying. His undergraduate resume was quite thin. It took him 5 riotous years to get a bachelor's degree. He finished in the bottom third of his law class and liked it down there. He had the reputation of a quick-talking party boy, often cocky because his father was such a big shot. Suddenly, forced to look for a job, he found interviews scarce. A real estate firm in Seabrook hired him, but he lasted only 8 months. To survive the overhead, he shared office space with other lawyers. To pay bills, he volunteered for every court-appointed indigent case on the docket. Ruiz County was too small for a public defender, and the indigent cases were parceled out by the judges. His eagerness to be in the courtroom cost him dearly when the Russo murder stunned the town. Every other lawyer either left or hid, and Tyler was appointed to represent Quincy Miller, who was presumed guilty the day of his arrest. For a 28-year-old lawyer with limited courtroom experience, his defense was nothing short of masterful. He fought fiercely, contested every piece of evidence, brawled with the state's witnesses, and believed firmly in his client's innocence. The first time I read the trial transcript, I was amused by his brashness in the courtroom. By the third reading, though, I realized that his scorched earth defense probably alienated the jury. Regardless, the kid had enormous potential as a trial lawyer. Then he quit the law. We drift along the edge of Paradise Island and dock at a resort. As we walk along the pier toward the hotel, Tyler says, "We're thinking about buying this place. It's for sale. I want to branch out and get away from shopping centers. My father-in-law is more conservative." "A Florida real estate developer who moves conservatively?" I nod as if I find this fascinating. Money talk gives me a migraine. Anything to do with finance, markets, hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, basis points, real estate, bonds, etc. And I glaze over. Since I don't have two nickels to rub together, I really don't care how others plot their fortunes. We amble through the lobby like a couple of tourists from Akron and take the elevator to the third floor where Tyler has a large suite. I follow him to a terrace with a lovely view of the beach and ocean beyond. He fetches two beers from a fridge, and we sit down for a talk. He begins with, "I admire you, Post, for what you're doing. I really do." I walked away from Quincy because I had no choice. But I've never believed he killed Keith Russo. I still think of him often. Who did? He exhales and takes a long drink from his bottle. He gazes at the ocean. We are under a large umbrella on a terrace with no sign of human activity anywhere in the vicinity except for some distant laughter on the beach. He looks at me and asks, "Are you wearing a wire, Post?" "Not today, thankfully." "Come on, Tyler, I'm not a cop." "You didn't answer my question." "No, I'm not wearing a wire. You need a strip search?" He nods and says, "Yes." I nod back, no problem. I step away from the table and strip down to my boxers. He watches closely, and when I've gone far enough, he says, "That's good." I get dressed and return to my seat and my beer. He says, "Sorry about that, Post, but I can't be too careful. You'll understand later." I raise both hands and say, "Look, Tyler, I have no idea what you have on your mind, so I'll just shut up and you do the talking, okay? I know you realize that everything is deathly confidential. The people who killed Keith Russo are still around somewhere, and they're afraid of the truth. You can trust me, okay?" He nods and says, "I think so. You ask me who killed Russo, and the answer is, I don't know. I have a good theory, in fact, an excellent one, and when I tell my story, I think you'll agree." I take a swig and say, "I'm all ears." He takes a deep breath and tries to relax. Alcohol is important here, and I drain my bottle. He gets two more beers from the fridge, then leans back in his chair and gazes across the ocean. I knew Keith Russo, and pretty well. He was about 10 years older and going places, already tired of the small town and dreaming of something bigger. I wasn't particularly fond of him. No one was, really. He and his wife were making some money repping drug dealers in Tampa, even had an apartment down there. Lots of rumors around Seabrook that they were planning to pull up stakes, leave the backwater, and step into the big leagues. He and Diana kept to themselves, like they were a cut above the rest of us small-town ham and eggers. Occasionally, they were forced to get their hands dirty when things were slow. Divorces, bankruptcies, wills and deeds. But that work was beneath them. The job Keith did for Quincy in his divorce was pathetic, and Quincy was rightly ticked off. They picked the perfect stooge, didn't they, Post? Disgruntled client goes berserk and kills lazy lawyer. Their plan worked. Yes, it did. The town was shocked. Quincy got arrested, and everybody breathed easier. All the lawyers hid, everyone but me, and I got the call. Had no choice. At first, I figured he was guilty, but he soon convinced me otherwise. I took the case, and it ruined my law practice. "You did a marvelous job at trial." He waves me off. "I don't care anymore. That was another life." He leans in close on his elbows, as if things are now even more serious. "This is what happened to me, Post. I've never told anyone this story, not even my wife, and you can't repeat it. Not that you'll want to because it's too dangerous, but here's what happened. After the trial, I was emotionally and physically exhausted. I was so disgusted with the trial and the verdict, and I hated the system. But after a few weeks, some of the fire returned because I had to do the appeal. I worked on it day and night, and convinced myself that I could sway the Florida Supreme Court, something that rarely happens." He takes a drink and studies the ocean. And the bad guys were watching me. I just knew it. I became paranoid about my phones, apartment, office, car, everything. There were two anonymous phone calls, and both times, a really eerie male voice said, "Back off." That's it. Just back off. I couldn't report this to the police because I didn't trust them. Fitzner was in control of everything, and he was the enemy. Hell, he was probably the voice on the other end. About 5 or 6 months after the trial, while I was working on the appeal, two of my law school buddies knew I needed to get away, so they planned a bone fishing trip to Belize. Ever tried bone fishing? I've never heard of bone fishing, no. It's a blast. You stalk them in the saltwater flats, great here in the Bahamas and throughout Central America. Belize has some of the best. My buddies invited me down, and I needed a break. Bone fishing is a real boys' adventure. No wives, no girlfriends, plenty of drinking. So I went. The second night there, we went to a beach party not far from our fishing lodge. Lots of locals, some women, plenty of gringos there to fish and drink. Things got pretty rowdy. We were chugging beers and rum punch, but not to the point of blacking out. We weren't college hammered, but my drink got spiked. And someone took me away. To where, I don't know. We'll never know. I woke up on the floor of a concrete cell with no windows. Hot as hell. A sauna. My head was splitting, and I needed to throw up. There was a small bottle of water on the floor, and I gulped it down. I had been stripped down to my boxers. I sat there on the hot floor for hours and waited. Then the door opened, and two really nasty boys with handguns came after me. They slapped me around, blindfolded me, and tied my wrists together, then marched me for probably half an hour down a dirt path. I was stumbling and dying of thirst, and every 10 steps or so, one of the thugs cussed me in Spanish and pushed me forward. When we stopped, they tied a rope to my wrist, stretched my arms above my head, and yanked me up. It hurt like hell and led to shoulder surgery a year later. But I wasn't thinking about later. I bounced off wooden beams as I went up and finally stopped at the top of a tower where they pulled off my blindfold and allowed me to soak in the scenery. We were at the edge of a pond or a swampy bayou or something about the size of a football field. The water was thick and brown and filled with crocodiles. Lots of crocodiles. With me on the deck, there were three more heavily armed dudes who weren't very friendly, and two skinny kids who couldn't have been more than 18. They were dark-skinned and completely naked. A zip line of sorts ran from the tower, dipped across the pond, and was tied off at a tree on the other side. If not for the crocs, it might have been a fun summertime swimming hole with a zip line. If not for the crocs. My head was pounding and my heart was about to explode. They picked up a burlap sack filled with bloody chickens and hitched it to the zip line, then released it. As it swung down to the water, it dripped blood, and this really excited the crocodiles. When the sack stopped over the center of the pond, one of the guards pulled a cord, and the dead chickens dropped in a heap on top of the crocs. They must have been starving because they went crazy. With the appetizer served, it was time for the entree. They grabbed the first skinny Latino boy and hitched his wrist to the zip line. He screamed as they kicked him off the tower and screamed even louder as he flew across the pond. When he stopped in the center, his toes were about 10 feet above the crocs. The poor boy was crying and screaming. It was awful. Just awful. Slowly a guard turned a crank, and down he went. He kicked frantically, as you can imagine. He kicked and screamed for his life. But soon his feet were in the water, and the crocs began ripping apart his flesh and bones. The guard kept turning the crank. The boy went farther down. I watched a human being eaten alive. He takes a drink and studies the ocean. Post, there is no way to describe the fear, the absolute horror of watching something as indescribable as that and knowing you're waiting in a very short line. I wet my boxers. I thought I was going to faint. I wanted to jump, but the guards had us. Fear as few people have ever known it. Facing a firing squad must be awful, but at least the killing is over in a flash. Being eaten alive? Well, anyway, as they were hitching up the second boy, I realized what was obvious, that I had been chosen to go last, so I could suffer the nightmare of watching the first two. Something else happened. I heard laughter off to my right, on the other side of a small building. Male voices, laughing at the sport. And I wondered how often these good old boys met here for fun and games. I made a move toward the edge of the platform, but a guard yanked me back by my hair and threw me against the railing. These guys were burly and nasty, and I wasn't really strong enough to resist. Not that it would have worked. I tried to look away, but the guard grabbed my hair again and hissed, "Look! You look!" They shoved the second boy off the tower. He screamed even louder, and when they dangled him above the crocodiles, he kicked and bawled something about Maria, Maria. When they began to lower him, I closed my eyes. The sounds of his flesh ripping and bones cracking were sickening. I finally fainted, but it didn't help my cause. They slapped me viciously, pulled me to my feet, hitched me to the zip line, and shoved me off the tower. I heard the laughter again. When I stopped above the middle of the pond, I glanced down. I told myself not to, but I couldn't help it. Nothing but blood, bone fragments, body parts, and all those frenzied crocodiles wanting more. When I realized I was descending, I thought about my mother and sister and how they would never know what happened to me. And it was good that they would never know. I didn't scream or yell or cry, but I couldn't stop kicking. When the first fat croc lunged for my foot, I heard a loud voice call out in Spanish. I began my ascent. They lowered me from the tower and put on the blindfold. I was too weak to walk, so they found a golf cart. I was thrown back into the same cell, where I curled into a ball on the concrete floor and cried and sweated for at least an hour before the guards returned. One knocked me down and pinned my arm against my back, while the other injected me with a drug. When I woke up, I was back in Belize, in the bed of a pickup truck driven by two cops. We stopped at the jail, and I followed them inside. One gave me a cup of coffee, while the other explained that my two friends were very worried about me. They had been told that I was in jail for public drunkenness, and that would be the best story to stick with. Once my head cleared and I was back at the fishing lodge, I talked to my buddies and tried to put together a timeline. I told them I'd been in jail, no big deal, just another adventure. The abduction lasted for about 40 hours, and I'm sure it involved a boat, a helicopter, and an airplane, but my memory was shot. The drugs. I couldn't wait to get out of Belize and back home. I'll never again subject myself to the jurisdiction of a third world country. I quit bone fishing, too. He stops and gulps some more beer. I'm too stunned to say anything, but manage to mumble, "That's insane." It still causes nightmares. I have to fib to my wife when I wake up yelling. It's always just under the surface. All I can do is shake my head. Back in Seabrook, I was a mess. I couldn't eat or sleep, couldn't stay at the office. I locked myself in my bedroom and tried to nap, always with a loaded gun. I was exhausted to the point of collapse because I couldn't sleep. I saw those two boys over and over. I heard their screams, their anguished cries, the horrifying frenzy of the hungry crocs, bones breaking, and laughter off in the distance. I thought about suicide, Post. I really did. He drains his bottle and goes to the fridge for more. He sits down and continues. Somehow I convinced myself that it was all a dream, caused by too much booze and a spiked drink. A month passed, and I slowly began to pull things together. Then this arrived in the mail. He reaches for a file I had not noticed. As he opens it, he says, "Post, I've never shown this to anyone." He hands me an 8x10 color photo. It's Tyler, in his boxers, dangling from the zip line, with his feet just inches above the raging open mouth and jagged teeth of a large crocodile. The terror in his face is indescribable. It's a close shot, with nothing in the background to indicate place or time. I gawk at it, then look at Tyler. He's wiping a tear from a cheek and says in a weak voice, "Look, I need to make a call, okay? It's business. Grab another beer and I'll be back in 15 minutes. There's more to the story." Chapter 23. I put the photo back in the file and leave it on the table, never to see it again, I hope. I walk to the edge of the terrace and gaze at the ocean. There are too many wild thoughts spinning around to grab just one and analyze it. But fear dominates them all. Fear that drove Tyler out of the profession. Fear that keeps his secrets buried. Fear that weakens my knees some 20 years after his abduction. I'm lost in my thoughts and do not hear him return to the terrace. He startles me with, "What's your main thought right now, Post?" He's standing beside me with black coffee in a paper cup. "Why didn't they just kill you? No one would ever know." The obvious question, and one that I've had 20 years to think about. My best answer is that they needed me. They had their conviction. Quincy was headed to prison forever. They must have had some concern about his appeal, and since I was writing it, they wanted me to back off, and I did. I raised all the obvious legal issues on appeal, but I really toned down the language. "I took a knee, Post. I mailed it in." "You've read it, right?" "Sure, I've read everything." "I thought your brief was sound. Legally, yes. But I was going through the motions. Not that it would have mattered. The Florida Supreme Court was not going to reverse his conviction regardless of what I wrote. Quincy had no idea. He thought I was still raging against his injustice. But I backed off." The court affirmed unanimously. No surprise there. I filed the usual perfunctory appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, denied as always. And I told Quincy it was over. "And that's why you didn't ask for post-conviction relief." "That, plus there was no new evidence at that time." I threw in the towel and walked away. Needless to say, I wasn't getting paid at that point. 2 years later, Quincy filed his own motions from prison, got one of the jailhouse lawyers to help him, but they went nowhere. He turns and walks back to the table and takes his seat. He places the file in an empty chair. I join him, and we sit for a long, silent spell. Finally, he says, "Just think of the logistics, Post. They knew I was going fishing in Belize. knew where I would be staying, so they must have been listening to my phones. This was before the internet, so no emails to hack. Think of the manpower it took to spike my drink, drag me away, load me up in a boat or plane, and take me to their little camp where they made sport out of feeding their enemies to the crocodiles. The zip line was pretty elaborate, the crocs plentiful and hungry.
A well-organized gang.
Yes, one with plenty of money, resources, contacts with local police, maybe border agents, everything the best narco-traffickers need. They certainly made a believer out of me. I finished the appeal, but I was a wreck. I finally got some counseling. Told my therapist I'd been threatened by people who could make good with their threats, and then I was cracking up over it. He got me through it, and I eventually packed up and left town. You need any more proof that Quincy didn't kill Russo?
No.
And I really didn't need this. This is a secret that will never be told post. And this is the reason I'm not getting involved with anyone's efforts to help Quincy.
So you know more than you're telling.
He considers this while he sips coffee. Let's just say that I know some things.
What can you tell me about Brad Fitzner? I assume you knew him pretty well back then.
There were suspicions about Fitzner back then, but they were always whispered. A few of the lawyers who worked the criminal beat, including me, heard more of the gossip than the others. There was a small port on the Gulf called Polley's Inlet. It was in Ruiz County, thus under his control. The rumors were that he allowed the drugs to come in there and get warehoused in remote parts of the county before being distributed north toward Atlanta. Again, only rumors. Fitzner was never caught, never charged. After I left, I watched from a distance and kept in touch with a couple of lawyer friends in Seabrook. The feds never got their hands on Brad.
And Kenny Taft?
Taft was killed not long before I left town. There were rumors that the murder did not go down the way Fitzner described. Again, like Russo, Fitzner was in charge of the investigation and could write the story any way he wanted. He made a big production of losing one of his own men. Big funeral, procession, cops from all over lining the streets. A glorious send-off for a fallen soldier.
Is the Taft angle important? I ask.
He goes silent and studies the ocean. To me, the answer becomes obvious, but he says, I don't know. Might be something there. I'm not going to push him. I've already gotten far more than I expected, and we'll talk again. I note his reluctance to discuss Kenny Taft and decide to move on. So why take out Keith Russo? I ask. He shrugs as if the answer should now be obvious. He did something to upset the gang, and they hit him. The quickest way to catch a bullet is to rat out. Maybe the DEA pressured him and flipped him. With Russo out of the way and Quincy taking the fall, it was soon business as usual. They wanted the conviction to stand, and I decided to go bone fishing. Fitzner retired to the Keys, where he lives in a nice condo appraised by the county at $1.6 million, I say. Not bad for a sheriff who earned $60,000 at his peak and didn't finish high school, so probably not too savvy of an investor. I'll bet most of his loot is buried offshore. Be careful where you dig, Post. You might find things you wish you'd left alone.
Digging is part of my job, but not mine.
This is all history for me. I have a good life with a beautiful wife and three teenagers. I'm not getting involved after today. Good luck and all that, but I don't want to see you again.
Understood.
Thanks for the meeting. This suite is yours if you want. If you stay, you can take a cab back to the airport in the morning.
Thanks, but I'll leave with you.
Chapter 24. According to Section 13A-10-129 of the Alabama Code of Criminal Conduct, a person who removes or alters physical evidence from an official proceeding is guilty of tampering. And though it is only a Class A misdemeanor, it can be punishable by up to 1 year in jail and a fine of $5,000. Normally, in a misdemeanor case, the complaining party, in this case the DA Chad Fallwright, would simply file an affidavit accusing me of the crime and ask the sheriff to issue a warrant for my arrest. But Chad is frightened these days because the greatest achievement of his lackluster career is about to become his biggest screw-up. He is up for re-election next year. Not that anybody really wants his job, and if it becomes known that he prosecuted and almost executed Duke Russell for someone else's murder, then he might lose some votes. So Chad is fighting back, and hard. Instead of pursuing the lofty goal of finding the truth and unraveling an injustice, he attacks me because I'm trying to prove him wrong and exonerate an innocent man. To prove his toughness, he convenes a grand jury in Verona and gets an indictment charging me with tampering. He calls Jim Biscoe with the Birmingham News and squawks about this major accomplishment. But Biscoe despises Chad and asks why he refuses to submit all 7 pubic hairs for DNA testing. Biscoe does not report the indictment. My pal in Alabama is Steve Rosenberg, a radical lawyer from New York who moved south and remains noticeably unassimilated in his strange surroundings. He runs a nonprofit in Birmingham and defends dozens of death penalty cases. Rosenberg calls Chad, and they engage in an extensive cuss fight, and not for the first time. When the dust settles, it is agreed that I will surrender myself to Chad in his office, get processed, and immediately appear before a judge to discuss bail. There is a chance that I could spend a night or two in jail, but this does not worry me. If my clients can endure decades in horrible prisons, I can certainly survive a brief stint in a county joint. This is my first indictment, and I'm quite proud of it. I have a book on my shelf about noted lawyers who were thrown in jail fighting for their clients, and I would be honored to join them. Rosenberg once spent a week behind bars for contempt in Mississippi. He still laughs about it, says he picked up some new clients. We meet in front of the courthouse and embrace. Steve is pushing 60 and looks more radical with age. His thick gray hair is shoulder length and unkempt. He has added an earring and a small tattoo across his carotid artery. He grew up a brawler in Brooklyn and practices law like a street fighter. He's fearless and likes nothing more than charging into old courthouses in backwater towns throughout the South and mixing it up with the locals. "All of this for one lousy pubic hair?" he laughs. "I could have loaned you one of mine." "More than likely it would be too gray," I reply. "Ridiculous, just ridiculous." We enter the courthouse and walk upstairs to Chad's office. The sheriff is waiting with 2 deputies, one of whom is holding a camera. In a show of real hospitality, the locals have agreed to go through the motions in the courthouse and avoid the jail, for now anyway. I sent them a set of my fingerprints 2 days ago. I pose for my mugshot, thank the sheriff, who seems bored with it all, and wait for Chad. When we are finally shown into his office, no one makes even the slightest effort to shake hands. Rosenberg and I thoroughly loathe this guy, and he feels the same toward us. As we struggle with the preliminary chatter, it is obvious that he is preoccupied, even nervous. We soon understand why. At 1 p.m., we enter the main courtroom and take our seats at the defense table. Chad assumes the other one with a couple of assistants. The courtroom is the domain of the Honorable Leon Rainey, a crusty old fossil who presided over Duke's trial and never gave the kid a break.
There are no spectators. No one cares. It's just a pubic hair taken by an innocence lawyer from Georgia. Chad's dream of generating a bit of publicity fails again. Instead of a grouchy old white man in a black robe, a young and very pretty black lady in a maroon robe appears on the bench and with a smile says good afternoon. Judge Marlowe informs us that Judge Rainey has taken a leave of absence because of a stroke last week and that she will be pinch-hitting until he returns. She is from Birmingham and has been sent in by special orders from the Alabama Supreme Court. We begin to understand why Chad is so nervous. His home field advantage has been annulled by an honest referee. Judge Marlowe's first order of business is my initial appearance and the issue of my bail. She nods at the court reporter, goes on the record, and begins pleasantly with, I've read the indictment, and frankly, Mr. Fallwright, there's not much to this case. Surely you have better things to do. Mr. Rosenberg, does your client still have possession of the pubic hair that was DNA tested? Rosenberg is on his feet. Sure does, Judge. It's right here on the table, and we would like to return it to Mr. Fallwright, or whoever has the evidence file these days. My client didn't tamper with or steal anything. He simply borrowed one of the pubic hairs. He was forced to, Your Honor, because Mr. Fallwright refuses to do DNA testing. Let me see it, she says. Rosenberg picks up a small plastic bag and hands it to her. Without opening it, she looks, strains, finally sees something, and puts it down. She frowns and shakes her head and says to Fallwright, You've got to be kidding. Chad stumbles to his feet and begins stuttering. He's been the DA here for 20 years, and for his entire career, he's had the protection of a like-minded right-winger with little sympathy for those accused of crimes. Leon Rainey was his predecessor in the DA's office. Suddenly, Chad is forced to play on a level field, and he does not know the rules.
This is a serious matter, Your Honor. He wails with fake indignation. The defendant, Mr. Post, admits he stole the evidence from the files. Files that are protected. Files that are sacrosanct.
Chad loves big words and often tries to impress juries with them, but reading the trial transcript, he often gets them wrong. She replies, Well, if I read the record correctly, the pubic hair in question was gone for over a year before you or anyone else realized it was missing, and it came to your attention only when Mr. Post told you about it.
We can't guard all of the old files, Your Honor.
She raises a hand and cuts him off.
Mr. Rosenberg, do you have a motion?
Yes, ma'am. I move to dismiss this charge against Mr. Post.
So ordered. She says immediately.
Chad's mouth falls open, and he manages to grunt before falling loudly into his chair. She glares at him with a look that frightens me, and I've just been cleared. She picks up another stack of papers and says,
Now, Mr. Rosenberg, I have before me your petition for post-conviction relief filed 2 months ago on behalf of Duke Russell. Since I'm the presiding judge and will be for an unknown period of time, I am inclined to proceed with this petition. Are you prepared to do so?
Rosenberg and I are on the verge of some serious laughter.
Yes, ma'am,
he replies at full throttle. Chad has turned pale and is once again struggling to get to his feet.
Mr. Fallwright, she asks.
No way, Judge, come on. The state has not even filed a response. How can we proceed?
You'll proceed if I tell you to proceed. The state has had 2 months to respond, so what's taking so long? These delays are unfair and unconscionable. Have a seat, please.
She nods at Rosenberg, and both lawyers sit down. Everyone takes a deep breath. She clears her throat and says,
At issue here is a simple request by the defense to DNA test all 7 pubic hairs taken from the crime scene. The defense is willing to bear the expense of the testing. DNA is now used every day to both include and exclude suspects and defendants. Yet, as I understand it, the state, through your office, Mr. Fallwright, is refusing to allow testing. Why? What are you afraid of? If the testing excludes Duke Russell, then we're looking at a wrongful conviction. If it nails Mr. Russell, you will have plenty of ammunition to argue he received a fair trial. I've read the file, Mr. Fallwright. All 1,400 pages of the trial transcript and everything else. The conviction of Mr. Russell was based on bite mark and hair analysis, both of which have been proven time and again to be wildly unreliable. I have doubts about this conviction, Mr. Fallwright, and I'm ordering DNA testing for all 7 hairs.
I'll appeal that order, Chad says without bothering to stand.
I'm sorry? Are you trying to address the court?
Chad stands again and says, I will appeal such an order.
Of course you will. Why are you so opposed to DNA testing, Mr. Fallwright?
Rosenberg and I exchange looks of sheer disbelief, with no small amount of humor thrown in. In our business, we rarely have the upper hand and almost never see a judge peel skin off a prosecutor. Our astonishment is hard to conceal. Chad, still standing, manages to say,
It's just not necessary, Your Honor. Duke Russell was convicted in a fair trial by fair-minded jurors in this very courtroom. We're just wasting time.
I'm not wasting time, Mr. Fallwright, but I believe you are. You're stalling and trying to avoid the inevitable. This tampering charge is further proof of that. I've ordered the testing, and if you appeal my order, you will only waste more time. I suggest you cooperate, and let's get it done. She glares at Chad with a withering look that rattles him. When he can't think of anything to say, she wraps up the hearing with,
I want all 7 pubic hairs on this desk within the hour. It would be awfully convenient for them to simply disappear.
Judge, please! Chad tries to protest. She wraps the gavel and says, Court's adjourned. Chad, of course, does not cooperate. He waits until the last possible moment to appeal her order, and the issue is sent to the state Supreme Court, where it could languish for a year or so. Up there, the Supremes have no deadline forcing them to rule on such matters, and they are notoriously slow, especially in post-conviction relief cases. Years ago, they affirmed Duke's conviction after his trial and set a date for his execution. Then they denied his first effort at relief. Most appellate judges, state and federal, despise these cases because they drag on for decades, and once they decide that a defendant is guilty, they rarely change their minds, regardless of new evidence. And so we wait. Rosenberg and I discuss the strategy of pushing hard for a hearing before Judge Marlowe. Our fear is that old Judge Rainey might recover and take his job back, though this is unlikely. He's in his early 80s, golden years for a federal judge, but a bit long in the tooth for an elected one. However, we are faced with the obvious reality that without DNA testing, we cannot prevail. I return to Holman and Death Row to visit with Duke. It's been over 3 months since I last saw him and delivered the news that we had found the real killer. That euphoric moment has long since passed. These days, his moods swing from raw anger to deep depression. Our phone conversations have not been pleasant. Prison is a nightmare for those who deserve it. For those who don't, it is a daily struggle to maintain some level of sanity. For those who suddenly learn that there is proof of their innocence,
yet they remain locked up? The situation is literally maddening.
Chapter 25. I'm driving on a two-lane highway headed east in either Mississippi or Alabama. It's hard to say because these pine forests all look the same. Savannah is the destination in general. I haven't been home in 3 weeks, and I need a break. My cell buzzes, and the ID says it's Glenn Colacurchy, the old lawyer in Seabrook. It's not him, but rather his comely little secretary, Bee, and she wants to know when I'll be back in the area. Glenn wants to talk, but would rather meet somewhere other than Seabrook. 3 days later, I walk into the Bull, a popular bar in Gainesville. In a booth near the back, I see Bee as she waves and begins scooting out. Seated across from her and spiffed up nicely is attorney Colacurchy. Blue seersucker suit, starched white shirt, striped bow tie, suspenders. Bee excuses herself, and I take her seat. The waitress informs us that the bartender just happens to be concocting his own special recipe of sangria, and we really should try it. We order 2 glasses.
I love Gainesville, Glenn says. I spent 7 years here in another lifetime. Great town, great university. What's your school post? Can't remember.
I don't recall mentioning it to him. Tennessee, undergrad, good old Rocky Top. He offers a slight grimace at this, says,
not my favorite song.
And I'm not much of a Gator fan either.
Of course not.
We've managed to skip the weather, which in the South consumes at least the first 5 minutes of every casual conversation between two men before the subject turns to football, which goes on for an average of 15 minutes. I am often almost rude in my desire to avoid wasting all this time. Let's skip the football, Glenn. That's not why we're here. The waitress delivers 2 impressive glasses of pinkish sangria on ice. When she's gone, he says,
no, it's not. My girl found your petition online and printed me a copy. Not much of a computer man myself. Interesting reading. Well-reasoned, well-argued, very convincing.
Thank you. That's what we do.
Got me to thinking some 20 years ago, after Kenny Taft got murdered. There was some speculation that that episode did not go down, like Fitzner said. A lot of rumors that Taft got ambushed by his own men, Fitzner's boys. Perhaps our fine sheriff was involved in the drug trade, as you suspect. Perhaps Taft knew too much. At any rate, that case has been cold for 20 years. No sign of the killers, no evidence at all.
I nod politely as he warms up. I hit my straw, and he follows my lead.
Taft's partner was a boy named Brace Gilmer, who walked away with minor injuries. Seems like he may have been nicked by a bullet, but nothing serious. I knew his mother, an old client from an old lawsuit. Gilmer left town not long after the killing and never came back. Years ago, I bumped into his mother, and we had a nice chat. She told me then, must have been 15 years ago, that Brace believed that he was also a target that night and just got lucky. He and Taft were the same age, 27, and got on well. Taft was the only black deputy and didn't have many friends. He also knew something about the Russo murder, at least according to Gilmer. Have you talked to him by chance?
We have not. We can't find him. Vicky can usually track down anyone in 24 hours, but so far Brace Gilmer has eluded us.
Didn't think so. His mother moved away some time back. I found her last week in a retirement home near Winter Haven. She's older than me and in bad health. But we had a nice chat on the phone. You want to talk to Gilmer?
Probably, I say with restraint. Gilmer is at the top of my list these days. Glenn slides over one of his business cards. On the back is scribbled the name Bruce Gilmer. The address is in Sun Valley. Idaho? I ask.
He was in the Marines and met a girl from there. His mother thinks he may not be too talkative. He got scared and left town a long time ago.
And changed his name.
Looks like it.
Why would the guy's mother give out his address if he doesn't want to talk? I ask. He circles an index finger around his ear to indicate she's crazy.
I suppose I caught her on a good day.
He laughs like he's really clever and pulls long and hard on his straw. I take a sip. His big nose is red and his eyes leak like a drinker's. I start to feel the alcohol. He continues.
And so, a few weeks ago, I was having drinks with another old fart lawyer in Seabrook. Guy you don't know. We used to be partners back in the day, but he quit after his wife died and left him some money. I told him about meeting you and about your theories and such, and I gave him a copy of your petition. He says he always suspected Fitzner got the wrong man because Fitzner wanted the wrong man. Keith knew too much and had to be disposed of. Frankly, though, Post, I just don't remember conversations like that at the time of the murder.
This old gossip is of no benefit at all. After a town rushes to judgment, it's only natural that some people take the time to reflect as the years pass. Most folks, though, are just relieved that somebody got convicted and the case is closed. I have what I need, and I'm unlikely to gather any more useful information. As he drains his glass, his eyelids begin to droop. He probably drinks his lunch most days and naps throughout the afternoon. We shake hands and say goodbye like old friends. I offer to get the check, but he's decided to have some more sangria. As I'm walking away, B appears out of nowhere, and with a big smile, says she'll see me later. Kenny Taft left behind a pregnant wife, Sybil, and a 2-year-old child. After his death, Sybil returned to her hometown of Ocala, became a schoolteacher, remarried, and had another child. Like nightfall, Frankie eases into town and finds her home, a nice split level in the suburbs. Vicky has done her research, and we know that Sybil is married to a high school principal. Their home is assessed at $170,000, and taxes last year were $18,000. There is one mortgage that is 8 years old. Both vehicles have bank loans. Evidently, she and her husband live a quiet life in a nice section of town. And Sybil does not wish to disturb her life. On the phone, she tells Frankie that she does not want to talk about her deceased husband. The tragedy of Kenny's murder was 20-plus years ago, and it took her a long time to get over it. The fact that the killers have never been found only makes it worse. No, she knows nothing that was not known back then. Frankie presses a little, and she gets upset. The line goes dead. He reports to me, and we decide to back off, for now. Driving nonstop for 3 days from Savannah to Boise would have been easier than flying there. Because of weather somewhere in between, I sit in the Atlanta airport for 13 hours as flights fall like dominoes. I camp out near a bar and watch the stranded walk in and hours later stagger out. Once again, I am thankful that alcohol is not my temptation. I eventually make it to Minneapolis, where I am informed that my flight to Boise is overbooked. I stand by and stand by, and am finally awarded the last seat. We arrive in Boise at 2:30 a.m., and of course, the rental car I reserved is not available because the rental desk is closed. Other than the frustration, though, this is not a big deal. I have no appointment in Sun Valley. Bruce Gilmer does not know I'm on my way. Leave it to Vicky to find a really cheap motel in this famous resort area. At dawn, I drag myself into a small room in a rundown tourist trap next door in Ketchum and sleep for hours. Gilmer is employed by a Sun Valley resort as a golf course manager. We don't know much about him, but since there are no divorce records for either Brace or Bruce Gilmer, we are assuming he is still married to the same woman. Nor could Vicky find any official record of Brace legally changing his name to Bruce. Regardless, he did a nice job of leaving Seabrook behind some 20 years ago. He's now 47, a year younger than me. Driving from Ketchum to Sun Valley, I can't take my eyes off the mountains and the scenery. The weather is a dream. It was 95 and sticky when I left Savannah. Here it's about 30 degrees cooler, and if there is humidity, I can't feel it. The resort is exclusive for members only, and this is tricky. But the collar always helps. I put it on and stop at the gate. I tell the guard I have an appointment with Bruce Gilmer. He checks a clipboard as cars line up behind me. Most are probably golfers eager to tee off. He finally gives me a pass and waves me through. At the pro shop, I ask for Mr. Gilmer and get directions. His office is in a building hidden from view and surrounded by tractors, mowers, and irrigation equipment. I ask a laborer, and he points to a man standing under a terrace talking on the phone. I ease behind him and wait. When the phone is put away, I step up and say, "Excuse me, are you Bruce Gilmer?" He turns, faces me, immediately notices the collar, and assumes I'm a minister of some variety instead of a nosy lawyer digging through his past. "I am. And you are?" "Cullen Post with Guardian Ministries," I say as I hand him my card. I've done this so often my timing is perfect. He studies the card, slowly extends a hand, says, "Nice to meet you." "And you. What can I do for you?" he asks with a smile. After all, the guy works in a service business. The customer first and all that. I'm an Episcopal priest, and I'm also a lawyer, an innocence lawyer. I work with clients who have been wrongfully convicted, and I try to get them out of prison. Men like Quincy Miller. He's my client now. "Can I have a few minutes of your time?" The smile vanishes and he glances around. "To talk about what?" "Kenny Taft." He sort of grunts and sort of laughs as his shoulders sag. He blinks a few times as if in disbelief and mumbles, "You gotta be kidding. Look, I'm one of the good guys, okay? I'm not here to frighten you or blow your cover. Kenny Taft knew something about the murder of Keith Russo, and maybe he took it to his grave. Maybe he didn't. I'm just chasing leads, Mr. Gilmer." "It's Bruce." He nods to a door and says, "Let's step into my office." Thankfully, he has no secretary. He spends his time outdoors, and his office has the cluttered look of a man who would rather repair a sprinkler head than type a letter. There's junk everywhere and old calendars tacked to the walls. He points to a chair and falls into one behind his metal desk. "How'd you find me?" he asks. "Just happened to be in the area." "No, seriously." "Well, you're not exactly hiding, Bruce. And what happened to Brace?" "How much do you know?" "A ton. I know Quincy Miller didn't kill Keith Russo. His murder was a gang hit, drug dealers, and Fitzner was probably covering for the gang. I doubt I'll ever find the man who pulled the trigger, but I don't have to. My job is to prove Quincy didn't do it."
"Good luck with that."
He takes off his cap and runs his fingers through his hair. "They're all long shots, but we win more than we lose. I've walked 8 of my clients out of prison."
"And this is all you do?"
You got it. I have 6 clients right now, including Quincy. Did you know him, by chance?
No. He grew up in Seabrook, same as Kenny Taft. But I'm from Alachua. Never met the man.
So you didn't work on the murder investigation?
Oh, no. Couldn't get near it. Fitzner was in charge, and he kept it all to himself.
Did you know Russo?
Not really. I knew who he was, saw him in court from time to time. It's a small town. You're convinced he wasn't killed by Quincy Miller?
100%. He ponders this for a moment. His eye and hand movements are slow. He never blinks. He's over the shock of someone from his past tracking him down and does not appear to be concerned. I say, I have a question, Bruce. Are you still hiding? He smiles and replies,
not really. It's been a long time, you know. My wife and I left in a hurry, sort of in the middle of the night, eager to leave the place behind, and for the first couple of years, I kept looking over my shoulder.
But why? Why did you leave, and what were you afraid of?
You know, Post, I'm not sure I want to talk about this. I don't know you. You don't know me. I left my baggage behind in Seabrook, and it can stay there for all I care.
Understood. But why would I repeat any of this to anyone else? You were not a witness in Quincy's case. I couldn't drag you back to Seabrook if I wanted to. You have nothing to say in court.
Then why are you here?
Because I believe Kenny Taft knew something about the Russo murder, and I'm desperate to find out.
Kenny can't talk.
Granted. But did he ever tell you something about Russo? He thinks long and hard and begins shaking his head.
I don't remember anything,
he says, but I doubt he's telling the truth. He's uncomfortable here, so he does what is expected and moves to another subject.
A gang hit. Like a contract killing?
Something like that.
How can you be so sure? I thought there was no doubt Miller killed the lawyer.
How can I be sure? The visual of Tyler hanging just inches above the Crocs flashes through my mind. I can't tell you everything I know, Bruce. I'm a lawyer, and most of my work is confidential.
If you say so. Look, I'm pretty busy right now.
He glances at his watch and does a lame job of acting as though he's now pressed for time. He suddenly wants me out of the room. Sure, I say. I'll be around for a few days, taking some time off. Can we talk again?
Talk about what?
I'd like to know what happened the night Kenny got killed.
How would that benefit your client?
You never know, Bruce. My job is to keep digging. You have my number.
Chapter 26. I take a lift to the top of Bald Mountain and slowly hike down 5,000 feet. I am pathetically out of shape and have many excuses for it. Number one is my nomadic lifestyle, which prevents any chance of a daily workout in a nice gym. The low-end motels Vicky finds do not advertise such amenities. Number two is the fact that I spend far too much time sitting and not standing or walking. At 48, my hips are beginning to ache, and I know it's from endless hours behind the wheel. On the plus side, I eat and drink as little as possible and have never touched tobacco. My last physical was 2 years ago, and the doctor said everything looked fine. Years ago, he told me that the secret to a long, healthy life is to consume as little food as possible. Exercise is important, but cannot reverse the damaging effects of too many calories. I have tried to follow his advice. So to celebrate the hike, I stop at a lovely lodge near the base and consume a cheeseburger and 2 beers while basking in the sun. I'm sure this place can be frightening in the winter. But in mid-July, it is heavenly. I call Bruce Gilmer's office number and get voicemail. I'll pester him today and tomorrow, then leave town.
I can't see making this journey again. Future conversations will be by phone, if they happen at all. I find a library in Ketchum and make myself at home. I have a stack of materials to read, including Guardian's assessment of a potential new client in North Carolina. Joey Barr has spent 7 years in prison for a rape he claims he didn't do. His victim agrees. Both have sworn that their relations were completely consensual. Joey is black, the girl is white. And when they were 17, they were caught in bed by her father, a rough character. He pressured her to file charges, point the finger, and keep doing so until Joey was convicted by an all-white jury. The girl's mother, who had divorced the girl's father and despised the man, took up Joey's cause after he was sent away. Mother and daughter have spent the past 5 years trying to convince the appellate courts and anyone else who might listen that Joey is innocent. Such is the nature of my daily reading. I haven't had the luxury of finishing a novel in years. The Brain Trust at Guardian believes that we are about to walk Duke Russell out of prison, so it's time to think about reloading our docket. I'm in a quiet reading room on the main floor of the Ketchum Public Library, with papers strewn about a small table, as if I own the place, when my phone vibrates. Bruce is getting off work and wants to talk. He drives a golf cart along an asphalt path, and we wind around the course. It's busy with golfers hacking away on a perfect cloudless day. He stops on a ridge overlooking a gorgeous fairway and puts on the brake. "Just beautiful," I say, absorbing the mountains in the distance.
"You play?"
he asks. "No, never have. I assume you have a low handicap."
"At one time, yes. But not so much now. Not enough time. A round takes 4 hours and it's hard to squeeze it in. I talked to my lawyer this morning. He's down there on the 10th green."
"What did he have to say?" I ask.
"Not much. Here's the deal, Post. I'm not going to say anything that might get me involved. Not that I know anything to begin with. I'm not signing an affidavit, and I'll ignore any subpoena. No court in Florida can touch me anyway."
"I'm not asking for any of that."
"Good. You said you wanted to talk about the night we were ambushed. How much do you know?"
"We have a copy of the file from the Florida State Police, Freedom of Information stuff. So we know the basics, know what you said to the investigators."
"Good. I didn't tell them everything, as you might guess. I got nicked in the shoulder and was in the hospital for a couple of days before I talked to anyone. Had time to think. You see, Post, I'm sure Fitzner set up the ambush and sent us in. I'm sure Kenny was the target, but they also tried to kill me, too. And they would have, but I got lucky."
"Lucky?" He holds up a hand, as if to say, "Hang on."
"It was a narrow gravel road with thick woods on both sides. Very dark, 3 a.m. We got hit from both sides in the rear, so there were several bad boys with guns. Man, it was awful. We were riding along having a laugh, not too worried about anything, and in a flash the rear window got blown out. Bullets were popping through the side windows. All hell broke loose. I don't remember stopping the car, but I did. Slammed it in park, then slid out the door and into a ditch, bullets smacking my door and ricocheting everywhere. I heard Kenny when he got hit. Back of the head. I had my service revolver loaded and cocked, but it was pitch black. As suddenly as it started, it stopped. I could hear men moving in the woods. The thugs were not leaving. They were getting closer. I peeked through some weeds, saw a silhouette, and fired. Nailed him. That was a good shot, Post. Back in the day. He screamed and yelled something, and Post, it was not in Spanish. No, sir. I know a cracker when I hear one, and that poor bastard grew up within 50 miles of Seabrook. They suddenly had a problem. A badly wounded comrade, maybe even a dead one. He needed help, but where could they go? Wasn't my problem, really. But they backed off, retreated, vanished in the woods.
I waited and waited and noticed blood on my left arm. After a few minutes, could have been 5, could have been 30, I crawled around the car and found Kenny. What a mess. Bullet entered from the rear. Exit wound took half of his face. Killed instantly. He was also hit in the torso several times. I got his gun, crawled along the ditch for 20 or so feet, made a little nest and dug in. I listened for a long time and heard nothing but the sounds of the night. No moon, nothing but blackness. According to the dispatcher's log, I called in at 4:02, said we'd been ambushed. Kenny was dead. Fitzner was the first one there, which seemed really odd, just like he was the first one at Russo's office. He was probably in the woods directing things, I say. Probably so. They took me to the hospital and treated my wound. Nothing bad. Just got grazed. But I asked for some meds, and they knocked me out. I told the doctors I didn't want to talk to anyone for a day or two, and they protected me.